From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The locks came off the gyms this week. Ahead on Only a Game, NBA players and team officials hastily prepare for an abbreviated season. Also, the latest chapter in the legend of Sidney Crosby. Boston celebrates Valentine's Day early, and the story of a football prospect determined to make it out of Compton, California, and on to the relatively safe collegiate gridiron. Also ahead, Louisiana inmates compete in the Angola Prison Rodeo.
Well, a lot of folks think it's crazy, but we're out here to win a little money that some of us don't ask our families for. I mean, our families didn't put us in the penitentiary.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This week, numbers of NBA players return to the teams that employ them. They can work out together in team facilities, though they'll have no significant contact with coaches, physical therapists, or team doctors until an agreement between the league and the players can be formally ratified next week. Chicago Bulls head coach Tom Thibodeau is trying to make the best of that situation.
No, you know, we can say hello to him, but that's about it.
The regular season will begin on Christmas Day, meaning that over the next 3 weeks, Thibodeau and his fellow coaches will be trying to construct rosters under pressure.
Yeah, it'll be different. Each and every year you're faced with new and different challenges. So then this will be a new challenge for us, and it'll be how quickly we can respond to it. And hopefully we can get a chance to see what kind of shape everybody's in. And then you got to move forward quickly.
The late start to the season may have some NBA fans feeling anxious for the league's return, but Bulls fan Thomas Hayes welcomes the truncated season.
After Christmas, that's when basketball is important. Before then, we into the football. And I think they started right on time because for January, February, March, that's when the basketball season kicks in.
Joining me now to speculate on what the season will look like when it kicks in is Howard Beck of the New York Times. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
What's the greatest challenge facing coaches and general managers this week?
Well, the biggest challenge is just getting a team together, a complete team together on the court so that they can hold training camps. The way the NBA has arranged this with such a small window is that on Friday, December 9th, training camps will open, but that will also be the first day of free agency. And there are teams out there that only have five or six guys under contract. There are going to be teams that really can't hold a practice on that first day of camp while their GMs are literally in the next room trying to sign players to fill out the roster.
The regular season will be shorter, of course, but teams will play more back-to-back games, sometimes even three nights in a row. Does this schedule work to the advantage of any particular team or any particular type of team?
Well, works to the advantage of the league and the players who wanted to get as many games in as possible to earn as much money as possible. As far as how it actually affects the competition, I don't think we'll know until the season unfolds. I think the one truth that I would hang my hat on is that it will favor teams that have been together for a while. The teams like the Boston Celtics, who have been together several years and their core is pretty much the same, I think they're okay. I think the Lakers are okay. And this is, of course, for the regular season. Who knows about the playoffs? But early on, you want cohesion and continuity.
There are rumors of New Orleans point guard Chris Paul perhaps landing in New York, Orlando center Dwight Howard going to Los Angeles, some pretty intriguing stuff. Do you expect a frenzy of trades as well as free agent signings next week?
I don't think the trades will happen right away. It's pretty rare that these things happen before the season starts. Nobody needs to rush into anything. You know, the pressure that is on New Orleans with Chris Paul and Orlando with Dwight Howard, and to an extent the Nets with Deron Williams, is that all three of these guys can opt out of their contracts next summer. I think those teams will explore all options, but the first impulse by a general manager is always find a way to keep them. The thing to keep an eye on will be what do those teams do to try to improve the surrounding casts to convince those guys to stay.
We have been assuming that next week the owners and the players will sign off on the new CBA, which is now only a so-called handshake agreement. Is there any reason to suppose that might not happen?
I don't think so. And in David Stern's case as the commissioner of the NBA, you know, he was checking daily, sometimes hourly, with the owners. He knows what he can and can't sell to them. By the way, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be, you know, 30-0 on the vote, but I don't think there'll be any question that he gets the simple majority he needs. The player side is more unpredictable just because there are more players. There's 440-something guys, and there were a lot of guys out there and agents out there who were very unhappy with the concessions that were being made all along. But I think those no votes are going to be out of the intent of not derailing it, but out of just registering the protest, because the players did give up an awful lot in this deal.
Howard Beck covers the NBA for the New York Times. Howard, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's a big deal when a Major League Baseball team hires a manager. In Boston on Thursday evening, it was a big enough deal to draw about 300 reporters, commentators, bloggers, and broadcasters to Fenway Park, where the Red Sox officially introduced Bobby Valentine to the press. Those looking for bad omens found them when Valentine and Red Sox general manager Ben Cherington first stood up to shake hands for the cameras. They knocked over one of the microphones on the table in front of them. Then the new manager fumbled with the buttons on his new jersey before finally managing to put it on.
I'm looking around for the teleprompter, and I don't see one.
Bobby Valentine hasn't managed in the major leagues since 2002. He has been working as a baseball analyst for ESPN for the past 2 years. But on Thursday, he left no doubt about how much he has wanted to get back to the dugout. He said he has particularly coveted the opportunity to manage the Red Sox.
I tried to not engage myself in this day because I didn't want to be heartbroken. I wanted this from the first time I heard the job was opening, and during the process, which was a long process from the beginning of November when we first met, I would wake up at night thinking there was a chance and then say, don't go there.
Valentine is 61. His previous managerial experience includes stints with the Texas Rangers, the New York Mets, with whom he reached the World Series, and Japan's Chiba Lotte Marines, whom he led to a championship in 2005. That experience has taught the manager lots of things. He knows, for example, not to fake it. That was apparent when one reporter asked Valentine what relief pitcher Daniel Bard's role would be with next season's Sox.
I have no idea.
The manager later said that reports, both laudatory and derogatory, regarding his persona had been exaggerated.
I am not the genius that I've heard people refer to me as. I am not the polarizing guy that people refer to me as. I'm not the monster that breathes fire that some people have referred to me as. But I'm a guy. I'm a regular human being with regular feelings and regular attributes that make me what I am, and I think some of them, as I've been told by people who know me, are okay.
Since the Red Sox record-breaking collapse in September, when they plunged from what appeared to be a lock on the playoffs to multiple October tee times, fans in Boston have been demanding a manager capable of whipping next year's team into shape. On Thursday night, the function room at Fenway Park was full of people inclined to assume that Bobby Valentine might be the guy who could do it. Of course, as Boston Globe writer and veteran Sox chronicler Nick Cafardo observed, that's not an assumption likely to survive a prolonged slump.
He's going to be expected to take this team at least back to the playoffs after their two-year absence. And if he doesn't, the honeymoon ends right there.
While the honeymoon is still in progress, Bobby Valentine plans to meet with and talk to as many of the current Sox as possible. He'll also be discussing potential acquisitions with Boston general manager Ben Cherington, to whom he expressed his gratitude on Thursday evening by saying, "I think we're going to do this, man, and I really appreciate this opportunity." Sidney Crosby returned to the ice on November 21st after almost 11 months away from it due to a concussion. In a mere 6 games, he's tallied a thoroughly impressive 11 points, which is perhaps even more striking considering that somehow he went scoreless in Thursday's 2-1 win over Washington. Here to help us appreciate Crosby's accomplishments is Bob McKenzie of Canadian Network TSN. Bob, welcome to Only a Game.
Glad to be here.
Before his return last week, Crosby had not played competitive hockey since January 1st. Is anybody surprised at how quickly he returned to form?
No, I don't think so. Special players do special things. And on top of that, he had been practicing at a very high tempo for quite a few weeks. Almost since towards the end of training camp, he was going 100% in practice. And practices aren't the same as games, but I don't recall another player who's gone 10 months between games in the National Hockey League who probably went in with a better foundation for conditioning, timing, practicing skills, was at an extremely high level for a prolonged period of time.
In a column you wrote last week, you contrasted Crosby's return to that of former Penguins star Mario Lemieux, who lit the league up in 1993 after treatment for cancer, and then again in 2000 after a three-year retirement. Do you think Crosby's comeback so far, anyway, has been as impressive as Lemieux's?
Well, it's different, and they're hard to compare, but, you can't get away from the fact that, Crosby's an iconic Pittsburgh player. Lemieux was an iconic Pittsburgh player. In 1993, he was diagnosed with cancer in January and missed a couple of months of NHL action. And when he left the NHL, he was well in the lead for the scoring race. When he came back, he was 12 points behind Pat LaFontaine, and he scored almost an average of 3 points a game in the final 20-odd games of the season to finish 12 points ahead of LaFontaine. It was one of the most remarkable things anybody's really ever done in the NHL. And no one's suggesting coming back from a concussion is anything like coming back from cancer. So there are comparisons to it. It's a pretty remarkable effort so far, and close to 2 points a game for Crosby since he's come back.
Do you expect that Sidney Crosby will someday be considered among the very greatest hockey players of all time?
Well, certainly, if he stays healthy and he's able to play a good long career, I don't have any doubts that he can play it at an extremely high level. I think he's arguably the best player in the game right now. The issue is sustaining it. We've seen whether it was Eric Lindros, whether it was Peter Forsberg, Jaromir Jagr, the list goes on and on. There's a lot of really good players that have played this game, but none of them have had the staying power and utter domination, especially statistically, that Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux had. Mm-hmm. You know, those guys, what they did was so far beyond their peers, you couldn't even get into a discussion and say who was close to Gretzky, who was close to Lemieux, other than each other, against each other. That's a challenge for guys like Crosby, and we're even seeing it with Ovechkin. You know, 2 years ago, people would have said Ovechkin was the best player in the game. He was dominant. He was dynamic. Now he's struggling to be a 30-goal scorer in this year's NHL. It's a hard league, the NHL, and it's really hard to sustain high-end excellence. But if anybody's going to do it, I would put my money on Crosby.
TSN hockey insider Bob McKenzie has been a hockey commentator for over 20 years. You can link to his column about Sidney Crosby's return at our website, onlyagame.org. Bob, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Appreciate it.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Oh, the games people play. At least the male people, at least one pub in the UK. Gordon McSween has invented a video game being played by gents using the urinals in a pub in Cambridge. Besides entertaining the lads, who'd otherwise just be, standing there, the game bombards each player with ads suggesting what they should order when they return to the bar. At the end of the game, players are encouraged to record their scores, which are posted to a live leaderboard, so competition between friends can be encouraged and a champion can be crowned. Then maybe the winner gets doused with Gatorade or something. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, inmates in an Indiana prison stage a rodeo. But first, Ketam Ham is an excellent high school football running back and safety who maintains impressive grades. Lots of college coaches have urged him to consider attending their schools, and Ham has every reason to look forward to a promising future if he can get through the present. In Straight Outta Compton, a collaboration between Sports Illustrated and CBS Sports, Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan chronicle the difficulties Katam Ham faces each day in a neighborhood characterized by gang violence. Katam Ham joins me now from NPR West. Katam, welcome to Only a Game.
How you doing?
And your father, Katam Sr., is there as well. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
And I'm also joined by Jeff Benedict. Jeff, welcome back to the program.
Hey, it's great to be back.
Katam, this story begins with your father, who was a member of a gang in Compton when you were born. Your mother convinced him to quit that life. Do you remember when he first warned you about gangs?
Yes, it started in elementary school. He told me that big brothers and stuff be in middle school, and some of them gang banging middle school also. So, like, they like pressured the younger kids to be a part of it. So that's where it started at, in elementary school for me.
One of the most dramatic incidents in the Sports Illustrated story occurs when Katam is only 12. Katam Sr., this is a matter of you and your son just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the wrong place was a basketball court. Tell us about that day.
Well, it was a gangbanger that was, that walked onto the basketball court across, and he was observing the game, and then he got into a kind of a back and forth with one of the other players. I knew the guy, not personally, but I knew him from going up to the park playing basketball. I would see him on occasions and just, say what's up to him. The guy walked up to the individual on the basketball court and put his gun out to him, put it on him and put it directly to his head and yelled some obscenities that he would take him out, meaning kill him. And I, immediately grabbed my son and position him behind me, and at that time I raised my hands and pleaded with the guy, please don't shoot this guy in front of my son. He doesn't need to see this. Eventually, after probably about 10 minutes or so, he put the gun down and he made the statement, "It's only because I know you is the reason why he's gonna live today." So, I definitely thanked the guy, and we made our way to our cars and we came home.
Jeff, I'm going to go for a little perspective here. As I mentioned, Katam has heard from lots of college coaches. How good a prospect is he?
I'm not a football coach, so I'm not the best to make that judgment. I mean, I think his statistics are as good as any of the players that we looked at in Compton for this story. He's got great speed. He's strong. He's got hands like Velcro. But to me, if you're a college recruiter, there's a level where all these athletes are so close to each other in talent that there's not much that distinguishes them from each other except other intangible qualities. And that's where I think he's head and shoulders above most student athletes coming out of high school, because his grades are very, very good. Any coach would love having a guy who's got the kind of leadership that he has. I mean, you love to find a kid who's self-disciplined, who can motivate himself, and who leads by example, and who's not going to be just swayed by the crowd, because it's very unusual.
Katam, are you blushing?
Yeah, a little bit.
One thing in Straight Outta Compton that surprised me was the contention that gangs tried to recruit athletes in order to convince other young men to join. I had always heard and read that often gangs abided by a kind of informal agreement to stay away from promising athletes. Katam Sr., I gather that has not been the case in Compton.
Everything is different. The respect factor, the way they do a lot of things is different than, say, some of the old, I call them the old-time gangbangers. It was a different respect factor.
Mm-hmm.
They tend not to have any respect or no remorse for anybody or anything, for that matter.
There is a terrifying story in the article where one of these gang members comes up to a young man that he doesn't even know in a fast food restaurant and asks him, "Where are you from?" And because he gets the wrong answer, that young man is dead.
And that happens every day. That happens every day. It's you hear one day and you're gone the next. I mean, they'll shoot you for nothing, And clearly that young man was shot for nothing.
Jeff, as you wrote this story and became familiar with the context of it, did you come to feel Katam Ham's experience was representative?
I think his experience is representative, but I think the way he deals with his experience is very unique. we saw many kids that are in the same situation that he's in. We didn't just go to Compton High. We went to Dominguez High. First of all, what's unique is he's got two parents. He's got a dad that's incredibly involved in his life. I mean, I saw that firsthand. I mean, he drove us to school in the morning. He's there to pick him up after practice. I didn't see many other fathers doing that. It's amazing that you have to have all that to get through an ordinary day. But I think the fact that he does that and that his parents do that is why he's where he is today.
Kitam, Jeff mentions rules. Tell me a little bit about your routine during a normal day.
I get up in the morning. I wash my face and stuff. I go back to my room. I look in the closet to see what I want to wear. I like to match, so I got to find the right pair of shoes to go with the right shirt. I go to school from 8 o'clock to 2:45. After that, at 3:15, practice start. After practice over, I go home. I eat. Take showers, then I probably stay up for the rest of the night doing my homework.
So there's no wandering around outside, obviously.
No.
Kitam Sr., tell me a little bit about what your goals or hopes are as Kitam Jr. moves on past high school and into college.
I'm just hoping that he's able to, first of all, get to college and graduate from college and pursue his career as an attorney.
That's the aim. He wants to be an attorney.
Yes. First.
With Armand Kitayen, Jeff Benedict wrote Straight Outta Compton, a special report which appears in the current Sports Illustrated. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
And Kitam Ham Jr. joined me from NPR West. I very much appreciate that. Thank you, Kitam.
Thank you.
And Kitam Sr. is by his side. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Rodeo has been embedded in the American landscape from the earliest days of ranching, a showcase for talented cowboys and cowgirls and big-time entertainment for fans who crowd arenas large and small. But as Only a Game's Ron Schachter found out when he recently visited Angola, Louisiana, there's at least one rodeo that isn't over until all the prisoners are counted.
2 hours before the start of the Angola Prison Rodeo, a tractor grooms the large oval in the middle of a concrete, tin-roofed stadium, seating over 10,000. This sold-out 47-year-old event, in which the competitors are inmates, takes place every Sunday in October and on one weekend in April. It draws rodeo fans and the curious from Louisiana and beyond, and it also brings some positive attention to the sprawling Louisiana State Penitentiary, about an hour north of Baton Rouge. Barely 10% of the more than 5,000 prisoners here, about half of them doing their time for murder, will ever go free from this prison. God bless America. During opening ceremonies, the 70 or so prisoners participating in today's rodeo join hands in a large circle at the center of the arena. Most have no riding experience, but inmate John Jones has been a rodeo regular for the past 12 years. He says the extra income, as well as the adrenaline rush, make it worth the perils of taking on angry bulls and wild horses.
Well, a lot of folks think it's crazy, but we're out here to win a little money that some of us don't ask our families for. I mean, our families didn't put us in the penitentiary.
Joseph Martin, a 3-year rodeo veteran who's serving life, says he gets something more out of competing.
I got nothing to lose. This is what I live for now. I'm here by myself, no family support on the outside, so this is my Christmas. For me, last week, I had a little kid holler out my name, and, you know, he was rooting for me. That made me feel good. And he was having fun, so that made me feel even better. You know, it reminded me back when I was a kid, which was a long time ago.
The closest thing to Angola's staff cowboy is Mike Vinoy. For the past 30 years, he's been the farm manager on this 18,000-acre former southern plantation. Vinoy supervises the prisoners who tend Angola's 2,000 head of cattle and thousands of acres of crops.
Most of these guys here never saw an animal before they come here. Never saw a horse or a cow before they come to Angola.
Vinoy offers tips to the competitors, from keeping their chins tucked in while riding the bulls to leaning back when they're on the horses. An outside company provides the bulls and bucking broncos for the rodeo. Vinoy adds that these animals are less formidable than those on the pro rodeo circuit.
We use like bulls they use for high school kids to ride. They're not aggressive. They don't jump as hard, buck as hard. You know, it's what professionals ride. And we're not trying to get anybody hurt over here or killed, you know.
Today's rodeo contestants are decked out in safety helmets and long-sleeve shirts with broad vertical black and white stripes. There's even a convict-related theme to the rodeo events, starting with Bust Out, in which eight prisoners, precariously perched on eight snorting bulls, break from the starting chutes. In barely 2 seconds, all of the riders are unseated and scrambling on the ground for safety. While some stay on longer during the bareback riding competition, most of the events here call for less skill and experience. Instead of calf roping from horseback, teams of prisoners standing on the ground try to tackle the calves released in front of them. In another contest, two prisoners have to control a wild horse that's already been roped, while a third tries to scramble aboard. Then there's the wild cow milking competition. The event, Convict Poker, draws on a distinctly different set of abilities as a charging bull takes aim at four card players sitting at a table in the middle of the ring. The champion is the last one to leave his seat. Joseph Martin won this event last week with a simple approach.
Don't move. Don't move. Last week, the bull hit the table and he spun around and he was actually, I could have actually reached out and petted him. He was that close. And you just got to think, man, don't move. It's actually, believe it or not, it's playing poker with a bull. Who can sit there the stillest, the longest, you know?
Movement is the name of the game in the Angola Rodeo's final event, Guts and Glory, which pits a large and ornery bull against the entire cast of prisoners. Each competes to grab the poker chip posted between the animal's long horns, resulting in plenty of human bovine altercations. After arriving 17 years ago, Angola warden Burl Kane expanded the rodeo, built the arena entirely with inmate labor, and started a prisoner crafts fair on rodeo days. He says programs like these have prevented some of the problems plaguing other large prisons.
Because I knew if we could keep these inmates really busy and focused, we wouldn't have as much violence. It was a very violent prison back then, and so it worked. They got busy. They had other purposes other than be predators on each other. Then I didn't have any gangs because everybody belonged to a club.
Back in the rodeo arena, inmate John Jones, who over the past 12 years has managed to avoid the broken bones, joint dislocations, and concussions that often come with this sport, is thinking about hanging up his spurs.
Well, believe it or not, I have a female friend that told me to retire from it, that she wants me in one piece and she don't want me being broke up. So this may be my last time.
Joseph Martin, who participated in four events today, admits that rodeo is still a consuming passion for him, and one which he's aiming to improve on, with a little help from his cellmates.
You know, people watch the rodeo back in the dorms, and I asked them, you know, where my mistakes were, and they tell you, hey, you know, this is where you messed up, and you think, well, don't do that again. And that's how you're getting better and better. I've been on a lot of...
Martin has already signed up for the next edition of the Angola Rodeo in late April. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
And I ride the rodeo, Angola Rodeo. I ride the rodeo, Warden Kane. And I rode the bucking man. I rode the bucking man. I rode the bucking mare, broke me down.
You're listening to Only a Game. On November 20th in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, the Johnson State women's rugby team captured the Division IV championship with a 12-5 win over previously undefeated Albright College of Pennsylvania. The title came in Johnson State's first season of competition. Joining me now on the line from Johnson, Vermont, is JSC rugby team co-captain Molly Banks. Molly, only 6 of your team's 18 players had ever played rugby before. How did you manage to win a championship?
It was a little tricky. yeah, this season did start out a little bit rocky. We were trying to make sure that we could fill a full side of 15 players. And at a small college like Johnson State, which barely even has 2,000 students, it was going to be a little tricky.
Tell me about this recruiting. Did you sort of walk around campus and when you saw a big kid, you'd say, hey, you look like a rugby player?
Well, most of our team's actually really, really small. Yeah, we just kind of run around campus yelling JSC rugby.
Has the tiny town of Johnson, Vermont, I understand the population is about 3,000, gone rugby mad as a result of your victory?
Yep, the one bar in town did put up a sign for us.
What did it say?
Big congratulations.
Now, all right, you are the Division IV champions. I have to acknowledge I had not been aware that there was a Division IV. What is that anyway?
Yeah, a lot of people say that. Really, all the state schools in Vermont are D4.
Any worries that, you know, with the glory of your success, there are going to be calls to either, you know, tear this team apart or else move you up to Division III?
Well, I'm pretty sure that we are going to get put into Division III since we've beat all the teams in Division IV. Yeah.
Your coach, Don Allen, said of this season, and I'm quoting now, you can't start any lower and get any higher. If that's true, should Johnson State Rugby just pack it in and say, okay, our work here is done?
Yeah, you know, finish out with perfect scores. This season really was a storybook season. We never, ever expected to win nationals. We always just came to practice to exercise and have fun and, you know, learn how to play a new game, get together, do something outside of our dorms, and it turned out to work really well.
Molly Banks is co-captain of the 2011 champion Johnson State Rugby College team. She joined me from Johnson, Vermont. Molly, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much for having me.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
If you hadn't previously noticed that the NBA will soon be back in business, an ad that ran in Craigslist in Cleveland this week might have tipped you off. According to Cleveland Scene magazine, the ad promoting a, quote, welcome back party for the NBA called for women, quote, 23 years old, hot, love to dance. It went on to say, quote, all you need to do is come to the party, where there would be NBA players with whom those answering the ad would be expected to, quote, mingle while looking good and having fun. Successful applicants will be paid $200 and all they can drink, and of course, quote, you must sign a confidentiality waiver and discretion is a must, because discretion, thy name is Craigslist. They're on Craigslist! Yeah. Craigslist! I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the best sports writing ever done by a guy who created Xena Warrior Princess. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who joins me from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison this week. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and say hi to my friend Julian.
I certainly will. Early last Saturday morning, the NBA announced that the league would return on December 25th with 3 games, and yesterday that number was amended to 5. Is this because fans were clamoring for Oklahoma City v. Orlando and Golden State against the Clippers?
I don't know about Golden State against the Clippers. We all know they're clamoring to see Kevin Durant and Blake Griffin, who is the new face of the NBA, who plays for the Clippers. So I suspect that's what's behind all of this.
All of this is happening, and yet the NBA doesn't actually have a new collective bargaining agreement ready to be ratified. The two sides began negotiating again on a number of, quote, non-economic matters yesterday with the hopes that they'll be finished by Wednesday. I guess the fact that they've gone ahead and declared the lockout over means it really was all about the money, eh?
Yeah, it was really all about power. It was really all about who controls, who rules, as Kevin Bacon says in JFK. But, you know, now they're going to piddle over the details a little bit and everything will be fine.
Numerous outlets reported this week that there has been a strong push, and I'm quoting there, to oust Players Association Director Billy Hunter from his post. What, the players didn't think they got him a good deal?
Oh, I'm smelling the fine hand of agents in this one, because the only people who really took a beating in the eventual settlement were the agents, because the players seemed to be, frankly, the players got more than I thought they would get, considering that, you know, that they were being told all along they couldn't win. There are very dissatisfied owners with this, but I sense the move on Billy Hunter is coming from the agents.
On Thursday, the chancellor of Syracuse University said that if the school had known about the audio tape in which ex-coach Bernie Fine's wife appears to acknowledge Fine's sexual abuse of minors, Fine would have been fired 8 years ago. Meanwhile, a semi-independent probe at ESPN suggests that the network had a responsibility to do more with the tape when it acquired it in 2003. Do you agree?
Yeah, this is an incredible mess. I think that ESPN is going to do some serious soul-searching on this one because it looks terrible now. But to be honest with you, I don't know how you verify a tape like that. Do you hire a voice recognition specialist in 2003 to verify it? That seems a little bit like using a divining rod to find water. I'm sure they look bad now. I'm sure they know they look bad now. I'm sure given the nature of the offenses, given the backdrop of the Penn State case and on and on and on, they feel they look really, really terrible at this.
Penn State, meanwhile, attempted to make amends for its own child rape scandal this week by pledging $1.5 million to a pair of sex crime victim advocacy groups. I guess this is a good move.
It's a good move, but it's not enough. And you know why it's not enough? Because nothing will ever be enough. Mm. The money is coming from whatever they make in their postseason revenues, depending on what ball game Penn State you go to. Penn State shouldn't be going to a ball game. That's the point. This is conscience money. This is the stuff we used to call back in my altar boy days when a guy would put in a really, really nice stained glass window in the church in memory of his wife. It meant he was fooling around at some point. This is all conscience money.
Buffalo Bills receiver Steve Johnson has been fined $10,000 for the touchdown celebration in which he pretended to shoot himself in the thigh to mock Jets receiver Plaxico Burress. Some are claiming the punishment was too light. Others think the celebration was pretty funny. Where do you fall?
I think it was hilarious myself, which is a reason why, Bill, neither you won't ever be commissioner of football because you don't care enough.
I was holding out hope.
I won't be commissioner of football because I think the guy should be on a commercial doing this for next week's game.
Those looking to find the perfect present for a public radio sports host need look no further, Charlie. I've always been a fan of the fact that the Green Bay Packers are owned by their fans, and the team is
Socialist.
Offering its first stock sale in 14 years. So will you be digging into your pocket for one of those $250 shares of the Packers?
Oh, I'm going to go into get as much money as I can and make you the majority stockholder, Bill, so you can change the name of the team to FC Green Bay.
And then they can't use their hands.
That's going to make Aaron Rodgers cry.
Ndamukong Suh was suspended for 2 games for shoving the head of Packers lineman Evan Dietrich Smith and then stomping on his arm. Suh has appealed the suspension and said, quote, "I made a mistake and learned from it." How closely do you suppose officials will be watching him when he returns to action for the Detroit Lions?
Well, considering he's made similar mistakes repeatedly and learned from none of them, I would say they're going to watch him very closely. At least he's abandoned the "I only stepped on his arm a couple of times because I was trying to get my balance" defense. Ndamukong Suh is an enormous talent, and it's time for him to stop being a jackass.
In his first 5 appearances since returning from concussion injury, Sidney Crosby racked up 11 points. He's cooled off a little bit since then, but this week he had some advice for Mark Stahl of the New York Rangers, who has been trying to return to action following his concussion. Was it good advice?
It's actually terrific advice. It was, take your time, don't let them rush you. It's your head, it's your brain. And I think if Sidney Crosby really steps up on this issue, this would be a real legacy for him to leave the NHL, to be the guy who the absolute superstar. Because Eric Lindros had a chance at that and didn't take it back when his career was ended because of concussions. And if Sidney Crosby gets up and becomes the face of the brain injury crusade in the National Hockey League, that would be a really great thing.
And finally, Charlie, in the spirit of the season, a sports club in Scottsdale, Arizona has been producing photographs that include Santa Claus. How can that possibly be controversial?
What can I say, Bill? You better really watch out, because Santa's packing. It's a gun club. and you can have your picture taken on Santa's lap with your AK or whatever.
Yeah,
in the spirit of the season. On Donder, on Blitzen. On Donder.
Charlie Pierce writes the politics blog for Esquire magazine. He's just broken the hearts of countless children with that, I'm sure. Anyway, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
God rest you, merry sniper men.
For almost 40 years, John Shulian wrote about sports and athletes for a variety of publications, and then he realized he was destined to create Xena, Warrior Princess, so he went to Hollywood and did that. Maybe all that stuff he wrote about heroic figures like Willie Mays, Joe Louis, and Joe Montana helped in that second career. In any case, some of John Shulian's best sports writing has been collected in Sometimes They Even Shook Your Hand, subtitled Portraits of Champions Who Walked Among Us, which is why John Shulian is joining me now from KPCC in Pasadena, California. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. It's good to be here.
Sometimes They Even Shook Your Hand. The title is kind of wistful. Is wistful what you were going for?
Wistful or ironic? because they don't always shake your hand. The era that I cover primarily in this book is one when relations between athletes and sports writers were much different, were much more casual, looser, friendlier even.
You spent time with a number of these athletes in order to write about them over the years, but one of the longer stories in the book is about Oscar Charleston, the Negro League star who died in 1954. Tell us about some of the Oscar Charleston stories you heard from his former teammates and opponents.
Well, he was ferocious. He was either the black Ty Cobb or Ty Cobb was the white Oscar Charleston. Bill James actually ranks Oscar Charleston ahead of Ty Cobb in his player rankings. And what Ty Cobb must be spinning under the sod somewhere. I mean, this was a guy who slid into third base in a Cuban Winter League game one year, cut up the third baseman, and so infuriated a Cuban soldier who was in the stands that the soldier came out of the stands and fought Oscar Charleston right there on the ball field, right there at third base. They're slugging it out. He was marvelous. He played on the great Homestead Grays team with Josh Gibson and Cool Papa Bell and all those guys. And he played first base, and he started playing, I think, in 1915 or 1916, something like that. You know, and I end the piece. I'm sorry to rattle on like this, but I end the piece with Oscar pinch hitting for the Stars, and he's 54, 55 years old, whatever he was. And he hits a triple, and he's dying when he gets to third base, right? So the next hitter up, he hits a fly ball, and all the guys on the bench are saying, Oscar, just stay at third base. Oscar Charleston, 54 years old, tags up and goes for home plate, and he just destroys the catcher. Just the mask goes one way, shin guards are popping off, glove, ball, everything, and Oscar Charleston scored the run.
In 1977, you wrote about Walter Payton for the Chicago Daily News, and he said, among other things, "I don't think anybody could analyze me." Was he right?
As it turns out, yes. He had obviously a very complicated life, as the new Jeff Pearlman book points out.
Yeah.
You know, a tragic life. I mean, this was a guy who was clearly put on earth to be one thing, which was a football player. And after that, he was lost. When the Walter Payton I dealt with was a nice enough guy. I mean, for a superstar, he was incredibly approachable. You just couldn't get him to sit still. He was incapable of sitting still. He just had to be on the go all the time. So you'd walk with him out to his car and you'd get three innocuous quotes and you'd watch him drive away, you know? And the joy of Walter Payton was really watching him play. Because I never saw a better football player. I saw better running backs. But this was a guy who, great runner, obviously, devastating blocker, could catch passes, could throw passes. In college, he kicked off and kicked points after. He could punt. He could do anything.
You include a piece you wrote about Nolan Ryan for the National Sports Daily in 1990. Would you read just the first paragraph of that piece for us, please?
Well, with great trepidation, I will, Bill. I'm guilty. I think we should establish that right away. At a time I can't quite pin down in my previous life as a newspaper sports columnist, I did indeed write that Nolan Ryan had, quote, a heart like a blister, close quote. Oh, infamy. Oh, ignominy. Oh, what a dummy.
Tell us a little bit about how you came up with had a blister for a heart and then how you discovered you were wrong.
Well, okay. I think I took this horribly cheap shot at Nolan Ryan, and it was. And Nolan, if you're listening, I'm down on my knees, and I'm begging your forgiveness. but, you know, it was in the heat of battle. I don't know what possessed me. You know, you always resort to a cheap shot or an easy line when you don't have any time to write. And I like to think that was what produce that horrible line, heart like a blister. Actually, it's not a bad line. It just was pinned to the wrong guy. you know, and then the piece came about because I was finishing off a package of chocolate chip cookies. And at the bottom of it, they had a prize, and it was a baseball card of Nolan Ryan. And I looked at it, and I looked at his record, and I'm wiping the crumbs from my mouth, and I'm thinking, look at this record. This guy was a stud. I said he had a heart like a blister. I'm an idiot. It was a Proustian moment, actually, and you have very few of those in sports writing.
Are you okay with most of the rest of the stuff that you've said about athletes over the years?
Absolutely. Yeah.
That was the only one you got wrong.
Well, I am human, Bill. Look, my policy was always no regrets. You know, I wrote a lot of tough things. The tough pieces are not in the book. This wasn't that kind of book. As a columnist, you're obligated to take stands on certain issues, certain people. And that was what I did. And certainly, the one column that was probably where I was the toughest was about a kid named Quentin Daly, who was the Bulls' number one draft choice in, I don't know what year, 82, 83, something like that. He'd been in a messy situation with some student nurse at the University of San Francisco and held her hostage and terrorized her and was the most unrepentant creep I'd ever seen in my life. And so I gave him both barrels. And wound up on Oprah Winfrey's show as a result, and now tried to make me his poster boy for 15 minutes. So I guess somebody thought I was right about Quentin Daly.
You include an appreciation of W.C. Hinds in this book, and in your appreciation, we hear Mr. Hinds as he looks over an anthology of his work, and he says, hey, this is pretty good. It's almost like he surprises himself. Is that what you feel when you read some of your stories from the 70s and the 80s and so on?
I'm proud of a lot of the stuff I did. I hate to sound vainglorious, but I really am. I mean, I really bled over a lot of these things. I was not a fast writer. I carved them in stone most of the time. I wanted every piece to be as special or as good as I could make it. And nobody cared if it took me 15 minutes to write or 15 hours. They just wanted something in the paper that was good, and that was what I tried to give them.
John Shulian's collection of sports writing is titled Sometimes They Even Shook Your Hand, Portraits of Champions Who Walked Among Us. The book is published by University of Nebraska Press, and the author joined me from KPCC in Pasadena. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Tony Federico at NPR West and from Delal Pektus at WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks also to Badger Radio. Special thanks to Paul Veitkus. Our intern is Jillian Geib, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our Bobby Valentine photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from John Shulian, who compares writing a daily column to, well, to this.
It really is. It's like being married to a nymphomaniac. As soon as you're finished, you got to start again.
I'm not going to touch that. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.